A small plane crash north of Helena kills one person. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us why renewable energy advocates strongly oppose a new proposal from the Public Service Commission. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with the director of the Fort Belknap Fish and Game Department about why the tribes want some bison from Yellowstone National Park. Lewis and Clark County officials say one person was killed in the crash of a single-engine airplane north of Helena today. A witness, Don Heidi, says he was outside shortly after noon today when he heard the noise from the plane's engine change. He says he saw the plane spiral down and heard it crash. He called 911, and he said the only part of the airplane that remained intact was the tail section. The plane was based at the Helena Airport, and the victim's name has not been released.
And in other news from around the state, the Ravalli Republic reports a 6-year-old Missoula girl died yesterday following a boating accident on the Bitter Root River about 2 miles below the Woodside fishing access site. The driftwood boat that she was riding in capsized in the hydraulic step below a diversion dam between the Woodside and Tucker fishing access sites. The girl and others in the group ended up in the water, and several, including the victim, were caught in the strong currents behind the dam, said Ravalli County Sheriff Chris Hoffman. Emergency crews were dispatched at 2:46 p.m. Members of the Corvallis Fire Department and QRU Ravalli County Sheriff's Office, Ravalli County Search and Rescue, and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks responded to the call. When they arrived, Hoffman said CPR was already being performed on the girl on a gravel bar downstream from the diversion dam. The girl was transported via life flight to St. Patrick Hospital in Missoula, where she died. Her name was not released. There were no other injuries reported.
Authorities say a U.S. Army soldier from Montana's Blackfeet tribe died after his Humvee struck an improvised explosive device. Keith Heavy Runner of the Blackfeet Veterans Affairs Office says Chief Warrant Officer Lee James Williamson died of complications due to traumatic brain injury. Heavy Runner says the 44-year-old Williamson died Friday. He says the Department of Defense did not say where the explosion occurred. Pentagon spokesman Bill Speaks said today he cannot provide details on service member deaths until next of kin has been notified. Williamson and his wife, Sherry Williamson, were based at Fort Bragg. Williamson joined the military after graduating from Fairfield High School in 1988. The tribe says he is to be buried at Fort Bragg.
Officials with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes Law and Order Division are asking the public's help in looking for a missing St. Ignatius woman. The agency says 52-year-old Mary Jean Bugs Decker was last seen on Sunday, June 16th at the Silver Dollar Bar in St. Ignatius. Cur AM reports Decker is 5 feet 10 inches tall, weighs 190 pounds, and has brown hair and eyes. Anyone with information about her whereabouts is asked to call the Tribal Law and Order Department at 406-675-4700.
Renewable energy advocates are blasting a new proposal from the Montana Public Service Commission. The PSC is looking to change the rules for which small power production facilities qualify for certain standard rates. Opponents say the change could significantly hinder expansion of renewable energy production. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says supporters of the change say it would prevent costs for ratepayers.
The rule changes being debated by the PSC all stem from federal requirements, from the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act of 1978. And this act basically says if a small power generator, let's say a small wind farm, if that wind farm can be constructed and get power to a regulated utility for the same price it would take the utility to create the same amount of new power generation, then the utility has to buy that power at a certain rate. The idea is this will spur innovation. But the states can determine the size of these small power projects that are allowed under this rule. They're called qualifying facilities. What the Public Service Commission is proposing to do is to lower the size of facilities that qualify for this guaranteed rate. The current qualifying size is 10 megawatts. By comparison, a large wind farm outside of Judith Gap is about 135 megawatts. The commission wants to lower the qualifying facility size from 10 megawatts down to 100 kilowatts, 100 times smaller. Opponent Jeff Fox works as the Montana policy manager for the Renewable Northwest Project.
Basically, what you have here is a group of developers that would like to develop small energy projects, most of them renewable, to meet Northwestern customer needs and do it at the same price that it would cost Northwestern to meet those customer needs. This proposal would basically eliminate that class of developers by lowering the size of a project you can build to something so small it's uneconomic.
Landowner Rick Jarrett runs a ranch called the Crazy Mountain Cattle Company.
I'm a fifth generation on that ranch, and I'm having a real difficult time making a living on it. And we have a resource in the wind that I'd like to be able to sell.
He's been trying to get a wind farm on his property for about 10 years and opposes this rule change for the same reason. The wind farm he would be able to build under the proposed rules would be too small to be viable. But Northwestern Energy lead supply planner John Bushnell says the current policies allow too many renewable projects a guaranteed in.
The concern that Northwestern has is that we have no control over how many QF projects come for a contract, and that we would be essentially overrun with qualifying facility contracts.
Public Service Commissioner Kirk Bushman says the problem for Northwestern with wind, for example, is it's intermittent.
If they bring on a bunch more generators and they're producing power, let's say in the middle of the night when Northwestern doesn't want it and doesn't need it, there's no load, they still have to take that power.
Bushman says the commissioners will be debating this. Should the state allow more of these larger renewable energy projects with the higher qualifying facility level, or allow Northwestern Energy to buy more energy on the open market where the cost is lower, at least right now? The PSC is taking public comment on the proposal through the end of the week. Commissioner Bushman expects a decision to be made in the coming months. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The U.S. Senate is expected to pass a sweeping immigration reform bill later this week, but passage in the Republican-controlled House will be a lot tougher. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, is among the Obama administration officials lobbying for the bill's passage. In an interview with Montana Public Radio, Napolitano says the proposed reform is really an economic growth bill.
It's a big problem. It's been festering in our country for a long time. It needs to be addressed. It needs to be addressed comprehensively and in a bipartisan fashion. We are, moving down the road toward that goal.
The bill would strengthen border security and provide a path to citizenship for the 11 million immigrants currently living in the U.S. illegally. News Director Sally Mock will have a feature interview with Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano about the immigration reform tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
A new study suggests that flaws in how the government measures Yellowstone's grizzly bear population raise questions about whether the animals have recovered sufficiently to merit lifting federal protections. Lead author Daniel Doak of the University of Colorado says a major reason more bears have been counted in recent years is that more time is now spent counting bears. He says the population could be in decline even as officials consider revoking its threatened species status. But government biologists say there's no evidence of decline and that new population data show there are more than 700 grizzlies in and around Yellowstone National Park. That's up from prior estimates of roughly 600 bears. Doak's work was partially funded by the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Glacier National Park is beginning a new mountain goat research program 3 years after the deaths of two animals halted a previous study. Park officials said today the three-year study aims to find out how mountain goats are affected by roads, people, and trails in the Logan Pass area, one of the park's top visitor attractions. The park and the University of Montana will conduct the $150,000 study. They plan to collar and track between 20 and 25 mountain goats. In 2010, researchers were looking at how climate change affects the park's mountain goats. The study ended when two mountain goats died after being struck by tranquilizer darts. Glacier Natural Resources Program Manager Mark Beal says researchers will be using a different drug to sedate the goats.
In the just over 2 years since Zoo Montana lost its accreditation due to financial difficulties, officials say the zoo is improving its financial outlook, seeing more visitors, and may seek reaccreditation sometime in the next year. Zoo Executive Director Jeff Ewalt tells the Billings Gazette that zoo officials are happy with the progress they've made, but continue to work to establish renewable funding sources such as multi-year corporate pledges and an endowment. The zoo also has created educational programs both at the zoo and through schools and other groups. Ewalt says he and the board of directors have decided to make sure the zoo is on a solid foundation before seeking reaccreditation with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Board President Kim Welsenbach says the zoo's long-term goal is to become a tourist destination.
A new report finds a variety of birds are, and likely will be, well into the future, facing significant climate-related challenges. The National Wildlife Federation report, Shifting Skies, Migratory Birds in a Warming World, warns of significant shrinking of ranges, flooding of coastal beaches and marshes, and continued devastation of western pine forests by insects, all of which, the report concludes, could push some bird species to the point of extinction. Senator Max Baucus has helped introduce legislation that would require a more coordinated response to climate change, and President Obama recently reiterated his support for climate change action. The executive director of Montana Audubon, Steve Hoffman, says we must take immediate and significant action.
This is not something we can put off. We need to support political efforts by Baucus, by Obama, and policy efforts that are really going to, you know, confront the climate issue head on. And we need to be a world leader in climate policy. But, you know, we need to take individual action, but we also need to take action at the federal level, the state level, the local level. This is not something that's going to go away. We can't turn our backs on this. The science is clear.
We'll have more on this report later this week on Montana Evening Edition.
The Pink Grizzly Fireworks Stand in Missoula opened its doors today at 9 a.m. To be specific, it's Pink Windows on the corner of Russell and Wyoming. Reporter Ruth Eddy has more on one of the community's most well-known fireworks stands.
What's going on?
Not much, you?
We're just getting going. First day.
First day, what?
How are you guys doing?
Good.
Have a good summer so far?
Yeah.
My name's Dennis Mickelson, and I've been in the fireworks business a long time.
For 38 years. And before that, he was a customer.
Because I used to come down here, actually, when I was a child. And it's about a mile and a half. And then it was safe, so there wasn't any issues with that.
Three young boys on bikes bought poppers and a couple packs of firecrackers. But Dennis says that's a rarity.
We still do get the kids to come down, but there's just not as many as there used to be. So it used to be real busy and nickels and dimes and quarters. No, it's not quite as busy, but our sales are usually bigger items.
One, called Flawless, costs $99 and comes with 75 shots.
So you get one shot and it bursts into a color, and the next one might just be a burst of just a boom, you know, noise. And the shots that they send up, the colored shots, will vary. Some will have tails.
Nicholson says something like that is very similar to what you'd see at a big show, just not as high and a little less boom. When the stand was built 45 years ago, the money was used for college tuition. Now the money is helping with the grandkids' tuition, but it's still a very small percentage of the family's agricultural business. The Pink Grizzly's agricultural exemption makes the property, which is seemingly in city limits, outside city regulations preventing the sale of fireworks.
The Pink Grizzly's been a family business for years and years, and it's a, you know, a well-respected and well-known name in town, so we have a lot of people that come year after year.
This year, the city of Missoula says it's employing a zero-tolerance policy with fireworks in the city. Mickelson doesn't seem too worried about the tougher enforcement affecting his business.
You know, it may a little bit, but for the most part, no. It, you know, most people, a lot of people are taking them to the lake. A lot of people, you know, we do have a lot of county area around here.
Mickelson isn't sure even if harsher enforcement will be able to stop fireworks within the city.
A lot of people who decide they want to do it, just do it. And we'll just have to see. I don't think it will affect it this year. You know, if they really do go out and, you know, grab a 12-year-old kid and find his parents $100, then it may change next year. But we'll have to see.
The summer fireworks season lasts 12 days, ending midnight on the 5th. Mickelson says the first few days are slow. He has time to read Michael Crichton and do crosswords. But come Independence Day, the Grizzly will have two stands open and probably about 12 people working in them. All relatives, of course. The business is run by five siblings.
And then spouses, there's two of us that work pretty steady. And after that, it'll mostly be grandkids.
Even when it's just Dennis working, there's signs of the family all around. Literally, the handwritten neon green signs with names and prices also recommend family favorites.
BMX Bandits? Oh, our dog likes. My wife writes stuff down like that. She'll have my son's favorite. She'll write that. See, no, she wrote down Dennis likes.
street freak.
He says his favorite really is the unicorn fountain. It's a customer favorite too, something Mickelson says people remember and come back for. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
Last week, the state Supreme Court reversed a lower court ruling blocking the transfer of disease-free bison from Yellowstone National Park to tribal lands. Some 60-plus bison had already been relocated to the Fort Peck Reservation, and now the Fort Belknap Reservation hopes the ruling paves the way for them to receive some of the Yellowstone bison. The state of Montana sees the transfer as an alternative to slaughtering bison that wander out of the park. Mark Azure is director of the Fort Belknap Fish and Game Department. In tonight's feature interview, Azure talks with News Director Sally Mock about the bison's historic and contemporary importance to the reservation's Grovan and Assiniboine tribes. Azure says the tribes acquired a small herd of bison from the National Bison Range in 1974, a herd that has grown to 600. Azure says they raise bison for a variety of reasons.
We sell them for hunts, for members, for tribal members and non-tribal members. We have live sales that we do. For marketing, we have a jerky making facility here on the reservation, a smokehouse, we call it, the Little River Smokehouse, and they make buffalo jerky and beef jerky under the tribe's name. We use cultural events, powwows, weddings, funerals, memorials. We donate to all those powwow committees here, the Sundance Lodges. I just recently got a letter requesting an animal for a indigenous woman's gathering here on Fort Belknap next month. So it's just an array of different things. I mean, it's like this animal is helping us today, almost like it did 500 years ago.
And 500 years ago, the animal was crucial to the tribe's survival, wasn't it?
Absolutely. That's what we lived on. That was our main source of subsistence. And not just food, but, I mean, it was used for everything. So from building your lodge to utensils, the bladder for water, just a different... You know, a lot of different things that it was vital that animal was here to help the native folks in this area.
When you say that you use the herd now for weddings and funerals and indigenous women's gatherings, does that mean that they use the meat for those events, or is there some other use?
Well, normally, yeah, that's what it's for, is the meat. You know, it's to feed folks, but when they request that animal, we basically allow them to take everything and use it however they need to. So we don't just give them the meat and then we take everything else. They take what they need of that animal. If they don't use it all, some folks return part of the meat. We get hunters that come in here and shoot the animal and maybe want the head for the mount and the hide to tan, and they donate the meat back to the tribe.
But historically, the entire animal was used, and so that's still the case, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
How many bison can your land support?
You know, that really depends on how much land the tribes here want to set aside for buffalo. Right now, the current pasture that we have is 22,000 acres. We're probably at capacity with our current herd in there. We're looking forward to selling off almost 300 this fall, because our goal is to liquidate that herd and make room for those Yellowstone animals. The other pasture will hold 35 to 40 animals without any feed. Anything over that, then we'll have to supplemental feed them throughout the year.
Why do you want Yellowstone bison?
Well, it's, you know, a lot of different reasons. Number one is we want to save that animal from being slaughtered every time it wanders out of the park into the state of Montana.
Has that been painful for the tribes to witness that?
Well, it has, yeah. I don't know that we do that to any other animal in this state. It's just hard to see for us that here's an animal that sustained our people for centuries in this region. It's the last free-roaming herd that once roamed this region, to see it, because it stepped over an imaginary line that it's put down. It means more, you know, more to us than it's a nuisance, for sure. We can't and won't stand by and watch that happen. So that's why we got involved in this. Number two is that it's genetically pure bison. And if we are going to somehow find our niche in the buffalo meat market, then why not go with something that's 100% pure buffalo rather than something that has a percentage of cattle genes in it?
The tribe's bison have gotten into trouble in recent years with ranchers. Some of the bison have gotten through your fences and onto their land, and they haven't been happy about that. And that's why they, in part, why there was a suit brought to stop the transfer of Yellowstone bison. How have you mitigated those problems?
We have insurance on those animals, and we've asked those folks that incurred that damage to their property to file a claim with us. And we submitted that claim to the insurance company that holds the policy on the tribe's property, and those claims were paid.
Do you feel like you have fencing now that is adequate for the herd that you have and for additional bison?
I do, and we are in the process of replacing that west boundary fence on our buffalo pasture with something that we feel is just more reinforced, just a stronger type fence. And so we hope to get that started. You know, we'd hoped that we'd been started by now. But because of the weather and just trying to get all the planning for the bidding of the fence and how much material we're going to need, just all of that logistical stuff hammered out, we're just not quite there yet.
Because you do have to work that out, don't you, to get a new agreement with the state before you can get the Yellowstone bison? The
yeah.
state is going to require that you have strong fencing and so on.
That pasture for those Yellowstone animals is already complete. That's waiting. It's been done since last August, September. It's ready. That's 8-foot-high woven wire fence. It's in place. You know, that was part of this agreement, and before the lawsuit came into effect and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks was basically stopped from working with Fort Belknap on that memorandum of understanding, we already had one completed. It's a draft form, of course, and I sent that off to the Region 6 Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks director and asked that he review that. And let's get the discussion going. We'd like to see this thing, this MOU, completed as soon as possible so we can move those animals.
Assuming the animals are moved to Fort Belknap, one assumes that will be an important day for the tribes.
Very important. Very important.
I've been speaking with Mark Azure, who's director of the Fort Belknap Fish and Game. Mr. Azure, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight rain showers are likely with a slight chance of thunderstorms. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow will also be cloudy with a chance of rain showers. There's a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. Highs will be in the upper 60s to mid-70s. For central Montana, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies. A chance of showers and thunderstorms are likely. Some thunderstorms may produce damaging winds and large hail. Lows will be around 55 degrees. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will stick around 75 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be between 40 to 50 degrees. And tomorrow will also be cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms with highs between 70 and 80 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Julia Altimus. Thank you.
Nothing is quite as loud as the silence of a sawmill not running. Unfortunately, the sound of the closure of 28 sawmills in Montana since 1990 and the loss of over 3,200 direct, good-paying mill manufacturing jobs has been deafening. These closures and job losses are the direct result of the increase in federal timber harvest litigation during that same time. The last mill closure was a Smurfit Stone pulp and paper mill in Frenchtown. It was incredible that a mill sitting right smack in the middle of western Montana's wood basket could not get enough residual wood supply to keep the doors open. When Smurfit Stone locked the gate for the last time, just after Christmas 2009, 425 mill workers lost their jobs. The propaganda of habitual litigators would have one believe the reason we have lost so many mills was because Montana's milling infrastructure was simply unsustainable. Don't you believe it? During the same period of decline, net growth exceeded removals by a factor of 7.5 to 1. Take a walk in the woods. Montana's forests are bloated with too many trees per acre that are now succumbing to insect and disease at an alarming rate. Yet, a sustainable supply of wood fiber was the issue then, as it is now. Historically, Montana mills have relied on roughly 60 to 70% of the timber harvest being supplied by private timberlands, 5% from state forest lands, and 25 to 35% from federal forest lands. In recent years, federal timber, making its way to Montana mills, has dropped to roughly 8 to 15% of the total harvest, even though 67% of the non-reserved timber is on federally managed ground. Montana sawmills have not run at full capacity for any significant length of time since the late 1980s. Before the mills started closing down one by one, lumber production was averaging 1.2 billion board feet of timber. Since the closure of Smurfit Stone, lumber production dropped to an all-time low of 374 million board feet. I doubt there are many businesses that could have survived a 70% drop in the supply they needed to run their operations, especially for a prolonged period of time. In 1990, Montana Forest supported 12,646 direct jobs, with a payroll of roughly $400 million and $1.2 billion in annual sales. By 2012, forest products employment dropped to roughly 6,650 workers, with a payroll of $295 million and $880 million in annual sales. It is not just the loss to Montana's economy that is at stake when a mill closes. There is also an associated cost to the taxpayer. Absent a sawmill, the cost of treating federal timber shifts to the taxpayer and becomes a net drain on the federal budget. Whereas treating federal timber within a log haul distance to a sawmill is a net benefit to the federal budget, as timber receipts are generated and returned to the U.S. Treasury. Over the past couple of years, lawsuits affecting timber harvest thankfully started to decline. Those in the forest products industry believed by developing relationships with the conservation community, we had turned a corner. However, not all calling themselves environmentalists want to communicate and collaborate to find solutions to natural resource management. It is these outliers that are now back to the litigation business model of a few years ago. So why the sudden increase in lawsuits? I certainly cannot suppose to read their minds, but one could assume a couple factors. One being, Congress attached a pre-objection process to a recent budget bill. By the end of the 2013 fiscal year, disagreements over Forest Service projects must go through a pre-objection and resolution process before going to court. Habitual litigators do not want to sit down with the Forest Service and other stakeholders to resolve their concerns. Another reason could be that the increase is a preemptive response to federal lawmakers currently seeking to curtail those that game the system by filing numerous and frivolous lawsuits. Montana communities have taken a hit in recent years and are not likely to survive another blow brought by the increase in litigation. The sound of a sawmill not running is deafening. Every time a lawsuit is filed in federal court, the logging contractor, log hauler, mill manufacturer, and the community are all adversely impacted. On behalf of the Montana Wood Products Association, I am Julia Altimus. Thanks for listening. Julia Altimus is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtbr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.